Chapter 5 Vanishing Hitchhikers. Urban legends are older than Congress gaiters, but far more interesting. I'd heard most of them. From the dog in the microwave to ball lightning chasing a housewife in Preston, to the fried dodo leg found in a smiley fried chicken, to the carnivorous diatryma supposedly re-engineered and now living in the New Forest. I'd read all about the alien spaceship that crash-landed near Lambourne in 1952, the story that Charles Dickens was a woman, and that the president of the Goliath Corporation was actually a 142-year-old man kept alive in a bottle by medical science. Stories about spec ops abound, the favorite at present relating to something odd dug up in the Quantock Hills. Yes, I'd heard them all, never believed any of them. Then one day, I was one. Thursday next, a life in spec ops. I opened one eye, then the other. It was a warm summer's day on the Marlborough Downs. A light zephyr brought with it the delicate scent of honeysuckle and wild thyme. The air was warm and small puffy clouds were tinged red from the setting sun. I was standing by the side of a road in open country. In one direction I could just see a lone cyclist moving towards where I stood, and in the other the road wound away into the distance past fields in which sheep grazed peacefully. If this was life after death, then a lot of people had not much to worry about, and the church had delivered the goods after all. "Psst!" hissed a voice close at hand. I turned to see a figure crouched behind a large Goliath Corporation billboard advertising buy two, get one free grand pianos. "Dad?" He pulled me behind the billboard with him. "Don't stand there like a tourist Thursday," he snapped crossly. "Anyone would think you wanted to be seen." "Hi, Dad," I said fondly, giving him a hug. "Hello, hello," he said absently, glancing up and down the road and consulting the chronograph on his wrist and muttering, "Fundamental things apply as time goes by." I regarded my father as a sort of time-travelling knight-errant, but to the chronoguard he was nothing less than a criminal. He threw in his badge and went rogue 17 years ago, when his historical and moral differences brought him into conflict with the chronoguard High Chamber. The downside of this was that he didn't really exist at all in any accepted terms of the definition. The chronoguard had interrupted his conception in 1917 by a well-timed knock on his parents' front door. But despite all this, Dad was still around and I and my brothers had been born. "Things," Dad used to say, "are a whole lot weirder than we can know." He thought for a moment and made a few notes on the back of an envelope with a pencil stub. "How are you, by the way?" he asked. "I think I was just accidentally shot dead by a spec ops marksman." He burst out laughing but suddenly stopped when he saw I was serious. "Goodness," he said. "You do live an exciting life, but never fear. You can't die until you've lived, and you've barely started that at all. What's the news from home?" "A chronoguard officer turned up at my wedding bash wanting to know where you were." "Lavoisier?" "Yes, do you know him?"
"I should think so," sighed my father. "We were partners for nearly 7 centuries.
"He said you were very dangerous."
"No more dangerous than anyone else who dares speak the truth. How's your mother?"
"She's fine, although you might try and clear up that misunderstanding about Emma Hamilton."
"Emma and Lady Hamilton and I are simply good friends. There's nothing to it, I swear."
"Tell her that."
"I try, but you know what a temper she has. I only have to mention I've been anywhere near the turn of the 19th century and she gets in a frightful strop."
I looked around. "Where are we?"
"Summer of 72, he replied. "All well at work."
"We found a 33rd play by Shakespeare."
33, echoed my father. "That's odd. When I took the entire works back to the actor Shakespeare to distribute, there were only 18.
"Perhaps the actor Shakespeare started writing them himself," I suggested.
"By thunder, you could be right," he exclaimed. "He looked a bright spark. Tell me, how many comedies are there now?"
15.
"But I only gave him 3. They must have been so popular he started writing new ones himself."
"It would explain why all the comedies are pretty much the same," I added. "Spells, identical twins, shipwrecks."
"Usurped dukes, men dressed as women," continued my father. "You could be right."
"Wait a moment," I began. But my father, sensing my disquiet over the many seemingly impossible paradoxes in his work in the time stream, silenced me with his hand.
One day you'll understand and everything will be more different than you can at present possibly hope to imagine. I must have looked blank, for he checked the road again, leaned against the back of the billboard and continued. Remember, Thursday, that scientific thought, indeed any mode of thought, whether it be religious or philosophical or anything else, is just like the fashions that we wear, only much longer lived. It's a little like a boy band. Scientific thought, a boy band? How do you figure that? Well, every now and then a boy band comes along. We like it, buy the records, posters, parade them on TV, idolize them right up until... The next boy band, I suggested. Precisely. Aristotle was a boy band, a very good one, but only number 6 or 7. He was the best boy band until Isaac Newton. But even Newton was transplanted by an even newer boy band. Same haircuts, but different moves. Einstein, right?
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying?
That the way we think is nothing more than a passing fad?
Exactly. Hard to visualize a new way of thinking. Try this. Go 30 or 40 boy bands past Einstein. Where would we regard Einstein as someone who glimpsed a truth, played one good chord in 7 forgettable albums?
Where is this going, Dad?
I'm nearly there. Imagine a boy band so good that you never needed another boy band ever again, or even any more music. Can you imagine that?
It's hard. But yes, okay. He let this sink in for a moment.
When we reach that boy band, my dear, everything we have ever puzzled about becomes crystal clear, and we will kick ourselves that we hadn't thought of it earlier.
We will?
Sure, and you know the best thing about it? It's so devilishly simple.
I see, I replied, slightly dubiously. And when is this amazing boy band discovered?
Dad suddenly turned serious. That's why I'm here. Perhaps never, which would be frightfully awkward in the grand scheme of things, believe me. Did you see a cyclist on the road?
Yes.
Well, he said, consulting the large chronograph on his wrist, in 10 seconds that cyclist will be knocked over and killed.
And?
I asked, sensing that I was missing something.
He looked around furtively and lowered his voice.
Well, it seems that right here and now is the key event whereby we can avert whatever it is that destroys every single speck of life on this planet.
I looked into his earnest eyes. You're not kidding, are you?
He shook his head. In December 1985, your 1985, for some unaccountable reason, all the planet's organic matter turns to this.
He withdrew a plastic specimen bag from his pocket. It contained a thick, pinkish, opaque slime. I took the bag and shook it curiously as we heard a loud screech of tires and a sickly thud. A moment later, a broken body and twisted bicycle landed close by.
On the 12th of December at 2023, give or take a second or two, all organic material, every plant, insect, fish, bird, mammal, and the 3 billion human inhabitants of this planet will start turning to that. End of all of us. End of life. And there won't be that boy band I was telling you about. The problem is...
He went on as a car door slammed and we heard feet running towards us.
That we don't know why. The Chronogard are not doing any upstreaming work at present.
Why is that?
Labour dispute. They're on strike for shorter hours. Not actually less hours, you understand. Just the hours that they do work, they want to be, shorter.
So while the upstreamers are on strike, the world could end and everyone will die, including them. But that's crazy.
From an industrial action viewpoint, said my father, furrowing his brow and going silent for a moment, I think it's a very good strategy indeed. I hope they can thrash out a new agreement in time.
And we'll know if they don't because the world ends,
I remarked sarcastically. Oh, they'll come to some arrangement, explained my father, smiling. The dispute regarding undertime rates lasted almost 2 decades. Time's easy to waste when you got lots of it.
Okay, I sighed, unwilling to get too embroiled in SO12 labour disputes. What can we do about averting this crisis?
Global disasters are like ripples in a pond, sweet pea. There is always an epicentre, a place in time and space where it all begins, however innocuously.
I began to understand. I looked around at the summer's evening. The birds were twittering happily and barely a soul could be seen in any direction. This is the epicentre?
Exactly so. Doesn't look like much, does it? I've run trillions of time-stream models and the outcome is the same. Whatever happens here and now somehow relates to the averting of the crisis. And since the cyclist's death is the only event of any significance for hours in either direction, it has to be the key event. The cyclist must live to ensure the continued health of the planet. We stepped out from behind the billboard to confront the driver, a youngish man who was dressed in flares and black leather jacket. He was visibly panicking.
"Oh my God!"
he said as he stared at the broken body at our feet.
"Oh my God! Is he..."
"At the moment, yes," replied my father in a matter-of-fact sort of way as he filled his pipe.
"I must call an ambulance," stammered the man. "He could still be alive."
"Anyway," continued my father, ignoring the motorist completely, "the cyclist obviously does something or doesn't do something, and that's the key to this whole stupid mess."
"I wasn't speeding, you know," said the motorist quickly. "The engine might have been revving, but it was stuck in second."
"Hang on," I said, slightly confused. "You've been beyond 1985. Dad, you told me so yourself."
"I know that," replied my father grimly. "So we'd better get this absolutely right."
"There was a low sun," continued the driver as he thought hard, "and he swerved in front of me."
"Male guilt avoidance syndrome," explained my father. "It's a recognized medical condition by 2054.
Dad held me by the arm and there was a series of rapid flashes and an intense burst of noise, and we were about a half mile and 5 minutes in the direction the cyclist had come. He rode past and waved cheerily. We returned the wave and watched him pedal off. "Don't you stop him?"
"Tried. Doesn't work. Stole his bike, he borrowed a friend's. Diversion signs he ignored and the pool's wind didn't stop him either. I've tried everything. Time is the glue of the cosmos, Thursday, and it has to be eased apart. Try to force events and they end up whacking you on the frontal lobe like a cabbage from six paces. I thought you might have better luck. Lavoisier will have locked onto me by now. The car is due in 38 seconds. Hitch a ride and do your best."
"Wait," I said. "What about me?"
"I'll take you out again after the cyclist is safe."
"Back to where?" I asked suddenly. I had no desire to return the moment I'd left. "The Spec Ops marksman, Dad, remember? Can't you put me back there, say, 30 minutes earlier?" He smiled and gave me a wink.
"Give my love to your mother. Thanks for helping out. Well, time waits for no man, as we..."
But he was gone, melted into the air about me. I paused for a moment and put out a thumb to hail the approaching Jaguar. The car slowed and stopped, and the motorist, oblivious to the impending accident, smiled and asked me to hop aboard. I said nothing, jumped in, and we roared off.
"Just picked up the old girl this morning," mused the driver, more to himself than me. 3.8 litres with triple DCOE Webers, 6 cylinders of Big Cat, lovely."
"Mind the cyclist," I said as we rounded the corner. The driver stamped on the brake and swerved past the man on the bike.
"Bloody cyclists,"
he exclaimed. "Danger to themselves and everyone else."
"Where are you bound, little lady?"
"I'm, visiting my father," I explained, truthfully enough.
"Where does he live?"
"Everywhere," I replied.
"Wireless seems to be dead,"
Bowden announced, keying the mic and turning the knob.
"That's odd."
"No more odd than a double blowout," I told him, walking a few paces to the handy phone booth and picking up the Skyrail ticket.
"What have you found?"
asked Bowden. "A Skyrail day pass," I replied slowly, the broken images in my head that much clearer. "I'm going to take the Skyrail. There's a Neanderthal in trouble."
"How do you know?"
"Call it deja vu this time. Something's going to happen, and I'm part of it." I left my partner and walked briskly up to the station, showed my ticket to the inspector and climbed the steel steps to the platform. The doors of the shuttle hissed open and I stepped inside, this time knowing exactly what I had to do.